All my team is busy, so it's just me today. And so today I'm actually here with Mark Van Buren. And Mark has written a couple books on things about Buddhism and meditation. So we're going to talk to him about that. So to get started, I wanted to talk about your books first, Mark. According to the information I have, you have two books. One is the newest book, which is Your Life is Meditation. Your other book is...
A Fool's Guide to Actual Happiness.
Fool's Guide to Actual Happiness. Awesome. So can you tell me about who you are and what made you interested in writing books on meditation?
Ooh, I never been asked that question. I always ask why you started meditation or whatever, but why I decided to write a book. That's nice. Well, so to go back, my name is Mark Van Buren, and I call myself now a mental fitness trainer. It's just kind of a little sexier way to say I'm a meditation teacher. And I work at a gym, so I'm trying to get people from the gym in there. And you know, I'm a meditation instructor, yoga instructor, partial personal trainer sometimes. I play a lot of music. I'm a musician. And yeah, I just love all of those things. And my main passion is meditation and mindfulness and really how to realistically implement and practice those things, because there's a lot of hoo-ha stuff out there that's just like you just shake your head when you listen, and just feeding people things that are just not helpful, in my opinion. So I guess, you know, what drove me to wrote was, one, my passion, two, my own practice and seeing what it's done for me in my own life, what it's done for my private clients, what it's done for other people on the path that are not related to me or that I meet along the way. And I just want to share it. And it's just so practical. It's so simple and straightforward. You don't have to believe in anything. Like, there's no like hocus pocus in it. It's just like, this is how it is. And this is what's helpful, and very simple, practical stuff that anybody could use. And I was a terrible writer until college, and I just would write so much fluff and so much nonsense, and I could barely write a 2-page essay. But one semester, I wanted to write a long paper, which I technically published by myself, and it's called We Are God. I don't know if you can get it on it. It's on Amazon if you search for it, but I don't know if you can actually buy it. But when I was writing that, one of my teachers, Dr. Johnson, he was amazing at Montclair State University. Unfortunately, he retired, but he kicked my butt with writing. I would write something and he crossed out almost everything that I wrote. He's like, this is all fluff. This is all fluff. You don't need this. You don't need this. And he just kept just drilling me on, just say what you want to say. Stop putting all this extra stuff. You could put all that paragraph in one sentence and just make very clear sense, you know? So he was the one that really, you know, pushed me to learn how to write. And then once I got through that, which was just a brutal summer of just getting frustrated and knowing that every time I wrote something, he was going to cross half of it out. And it that whole process really taught me how to write just straightforward and direct. Just, this is what I want to say. And there's no fluff. There's no, and it's kind of how I teach too. It's like, I'm not going to give you the fluff. I'm not going to tell you you're going to hold crystals and your anxiety is going to magically go away, or, you know, fly, like burn sage and fluff it around your house and get rid of all the negative, you know, quote unquote emotions and just all this stuff that I don't follow. So yeah, I mean, that's what really motivated it. And then, funny enough, the first book, A Fool's Guide to Actual Happiness, had a different title. I don't know if you saw the other title of that.
No, I didn't.
No,
see
you
that.
Didn't see it. No. When you were, well, it's not available anymore, but the original title was called Be Your Shitty Self. And I, that's how it. I self-published it. And you know what? My publisher loved it too, but they also do books by the Dalai Lama and very like prominent Buddhist figures, you know, and I think for promotional purposes and getting it in certain magazines, we just kind of had to switch it. All that be your shitty self stuff is still in there. So you can like still get a taste of it. But I actually heard a talk and I can't find it, which is the craziest thing. I don't know if I dreamed it or what, but there was a talk where there was the teacher and I thought it was Pema Chodron, but I can never find it. And the person in the audience said, you know, I've been practicing for a while and no matter how much practice I put in, how many retreats I do, how mindful I am, I'm still just my same old shitty self. And I was like, huh, like what? That's where it clicked, like be your shitty self. And that's what really started A Fool's Guide to Actual Happiness, you know? So I self-published those two books through a friend of mine. He just runs this small thing. It's called Bryce Cullen Publishing. And it's like a self-publishing publisher, basically. So you pay him, he gets you set up with all the Amazon and Barnes and Noble and the IS whatever number that you got. And he'll edit it if you want. I recommend that. Just, you know, just helpful. But, you know, and then as time went on and I did pretty well, like on my own, I started sending them out. And sure enough, Wisdom Publications wrote me back like a week later. And I was shocked that they loved it. And, you know, then I got, I guess, what do you call it? Signed. I got taken on. I'm used to like band terms, you know, you got signed by the record label. So I got signed by Wisdom. And now I have these two books. So that's the long answer.
That's exciting. That had to be super exciting to have them. Because first of all, I know it's a lot of work. Writing a book is a lot of work. I haven't actually gotten to that step. I'm always like, I want to write a book. And I start writing a book and then life goes, you know, and then I just drop it.
Yeah.
So writing a book is a huge project because, you know, you think, okay, I'm just going to write this book. And you start writing all this stuff, and that alone is enough, I know. But then when you get through the editing process,
yeah,
that can be killer sometimes, trying to get through everything. And that alone, I think, is enough to make you go, eh, forget it. So right. Getting through that and then having Wisdom contact you, that's awesome. So exciting.
Yeah. And what was cool about republishing is I got to go back because I think the writing was a little immature. I mean, I was a lot younger. I don't know, 2014, 2015. So how long ago is that?
6-7 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So early mid 20s, you know, maybe a little late 20s. I don't know. I stink at math, but I was able, you know, years later after having kids, getting married, owning a house, you know, having people close to me die, watching my grandfather in hospice, just like life experiences, you know, and that's what really helped make it more practical and authentic. And that's a big word for me, authentic, because I think that a lot of spiritual practices, they just get so phony. You know, you like see the people and it's like, breathe in and open your heart like a lotus flower and let it blossom and, you know, find compassion all the time and never be angry and in those negative states, those lower states. And it's just like, no, I get angry still, you know, and like I think spirituality's got to come back down to earth a little bit. And I'm so appreciative when I meet authentic people. You know, one of my teachers in Zen, what I loved about her was she was just so real because, you know, for myself and my wife, like my wife doesn't really care for Buddhism that much or meditation. She's got her own way and it's fine. We kind of balance each other out because I'm kind of take life as it is. And she's kind of like, well, we got a plan still. And we so, you know, we're kind of like the yin and yang, but we're making it work after, you know, 9 years, 10 years, whatever. But I was a little upset like early on in my practice, like, cause I wanted her to be a part of it. And I wanted it to be something as special for her as it was for me. And I was just talking to her about that. And she told me, and this is like a Zen, like a Roshi, a priest, a Zen priest. And she's like, well, I'll tell you what, it took me and my husband 6 years of marriage counseling for him to feel comfortable with me becoming a Zen priest, you know, and just like sharing authentically like that, not saying, well, like, I'm just the all-knowing, you know, divine being. It's like, oh, like, I get that because I went through that. And I always appreciate teachers like that. Like, I don't want to be kissing anybody's feet, you know, and maybe that's like a Western phobia that we have or something, but I want to meet somebody like right where I am. And I want them to meet me there. And yes, I'm not saying that she's not further along than me. I think she's more life. She has more life experience, more meditation and Zen experience. I'm eager to hear what she has to say and I'm open to it, but I also like to hear that she's human too. You know, even like Pema Chodron, one of my favorite teachers, and Jack Kornfield, that they're always like talking about how they got mad or how something happened. And it's just like, oh, phew. Good. They're human too. And I have my flaws and that's cool. Like, I can just be my shitty self, you know, and that's not like being a, you know, tapping out and saying, I'm just going to be an a-hole all the time. You know, it's just, I have flaws. I have neurotic patterns and behaviors and difficulty with certain situations and things. And it's a workable situation. These are the ingredients of my life and none of them should be cast out or demonized or turned into this is negative or bad, because it's a part of you. And if you want to feel whole and complete, at least it's my belief that you'd want to include all that in some sort of skillful way, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, we fuck up, yeah. And then we get back on the cushion and we try to figure it out. And then we do a little bit better and then we fuck up again. And it's just like meditation. It's bringing it back in again and again and again.
That's a good name for a book. I fucked up again. Exactly. Or the first book could be I fucked up, and then the next one I fucked up again. We could have a series. It'd be fun. We should do that.
Somebody should publish it, right? Somebody should.
As long as I get some royalties, because I could use some cash right now.
So I have to talk to you about your day job, because I focus on really weird things, okay? Because I know you do like music and all this really cool stuff. And I saw that you work for a potato chip company, which we will not name. Thou that shall not be named.
Right.
Which potato chip company it is. But I think that's really cool, because that's such a mundane job. And
right.
How did you get to that job? I'm just curious.
Well, I never really wanted a full-time job before I had kids. It was a very difficult thing for me to comprehend that I'm going to give someone else the power over my life, you know, when I can go on vacation and just a lot of my time. I was very much into me and my time, and I didn't like the idea of that. But then I had my son. I have three kids now, but at the time I just had my son. And we really needed stability and we really needed benefits. And my uncle was working for the company at the time. And he said, just apply and try. I mean, I was trying all different kinds of things and I've always been all over the place. And, but this just kind of fell into my lap, and it's very weird. Like, I don't know if this happens for everybody, if I'm just lucky or what, but I kind of have this trusting spirit, you know, like in life, you know, I don't know what it is. I'm not saying that I still can't get cancer or that I'm still not going to die or age or have bad things happen, but I just trust in the unfolding of it. And I find that when it's the right time for things, they just kind of arrive. And I know that sounds so new agey and hokey pokey, but it's just seems to be true. That's just what my experience is showing. And if I don't like worry about it or stress about it, things happen. Like just recently, we just switched from oil to gas in our house. It's like a $10,000 ordeal. And sure enough, I get some random opportunity to make some more money, a couple actually random opportunities, you know, and it's just like, things just happen like that, you know? And I think that I don't know. I don't want to get too weird philosophy, so I'll leave it at that. But yes, I do work at a chip company, and it's been an amazing practice for me, actually, because my neurotic pattern is when something gets hard and it's not exciting and new anymore, I need to run away. You know, that's how I was growing up. I'd stay at a job. It was cool. It was exciting. And then that excitement wore off and I'd find something else. I have this girlfriend. And then I would feel like after the excitement, I would feel empty and lonely again. And I'd be like, I guess I'm not in love anymore. I need to find someone else. And then, you know, changing majors in college. And it was just constant novelty that I needed because I was trying to run away from this emptiness, from this hole in my heart that I couldn't fill with anything, but I could temporarily fill it. So I had to keep temporarily filling it up. And, you know, obviously my life changed dramatically. Getting married, that's a big commitment. Getting a job 40 hours a week, 45 hours a week, actually, I should say. Having a child, you know, so I was really put face to face with my own neurotic patterns of running away and having to have excitement. And I had to go through a long period of what I'd call detox, right? To just my exciting ways of living. Like, not that I wasn't like a drug addict or anything like insane like that, but I just was a very exciting person doing exciting things, traveling, and all that stuff. So coming to an ordinary life, 45 hours, you know, working, only going away twice a year, you know, being with my wife for, you know, almost 10 years now, 9 years married, 10 years. We made it past the eight. Apparently people only are married for 8 years. I never heard of this, but I feel good that I made it past something like that, you know? So, you know, being able to work with my mind and learn to feel the feelings I don't want to feel, or I didn't want to feel, and make friends with them and learn to relate to them differently and allow them to be there and allow them to come to work with me and realize that the anxiety is not from the job or the person or the situation, but it's my own reaction. And that's something that I can work with because it's mine. You know, I might not be able to stop things from arising, but I can find different ways to work with it. I can, you know, after 13 years of practice, thousands of hours of sitting down and staring at a wall, I realize that things don't last, you know, and I have an experiential understanding of that. I can sit with anger, and after 30 minutes, it's not there anymore. I can, you know, go for a walk with emptiness or sadness, and then it's gone, you know, or it just lessens or whatever happens. But, you know, it's all part of the practice. And being at this job, I mean, I had to wake up some days 2:15 in the morning. Every Friday, I'm up at 2:30. Every other day, I'm up at 4, working 9 hours at least. And then that's not even with the kids, with the private clients, with the work at the gym and the hospital and all these other things I'm doing. So it's such a great teacher to be in situations you don't like. And I'm not talking about my marriage. I'm talking about my job. You know, just being in a job where it's like, it was hard the first year of this chip company. Like, you just are all over the place. You don't know what your schedule is. You don't know what days off you're going to have. They switch you last minute. They move you around. It's stressful. And you go to places you don't want to be in, towns that are a little like shady, to put it that way, that I don't want to be in, that I could get like easily robbed or, you know, like, just, I don't know. But anyway, it's all practice. And then throw on top of that the really miserable, egotistical people in the business, not in my company. I have great people in my company, but the receivers, the grocery managers, the store managers, there's a lot of personalities, a lot of people who like to wave around their control and things like that. And I mean, that's practice too, dealing with difficult people. You learn patience, you learn kindness, you learn how to diffuse other people's, you know, anger so that you don't exacerbate it, you know? So, yeah.
Absolutely. I think working with the public big time is definitely a practice, and parenting, which I'm sure you are in the thick of now with your children, is huge, huge. Part of practice, parenting. I wish I would have found this practice back when my kids were little. I feel like I became a better parent now. And they're older. I mean, it still helped me with them being older, because definitely through the teenage years, I definitely needed that. I did want to ask you too about this mental fitness training, because that's that was intriguing. So it's sort of kind of like working out like in a gym, but it's for the mind. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. And I'm sure all the Buddhist people are going to be rolling their eyes right now, but you know, the McMindfulness. I don't teach McMindfulness, by the way. I try to stay as authentic as I can without scaring people. And I mean, mental fitness training, I hate to say it, but it is like Buddhism 101, basically, just in just with different words, not even with different words. I mean, really, I teach people about awareness. And really, that's like the strengthening. What am I strengthening? I'm strengthening my ability to pay attention, right? And not to pay attention to be more successful or more, you know, financially, whatever, comfortable. I mean, if that comes, that's wonderful. But paying attention to really see what causes more suffering and what leads to more ease, right? And how are we using this one precious life we have? And are we habitually, unconsciously, you know, just reacting and just thinking about ourselves? Or are we learning to kind of work with our neurotic patterns and our difficulties and also help others in the process? You know, and it's just, it's a way to just see clearly without getting swept away. And now for me, meditation is about cultivating particular qualities of mind that you can go out into the world with, right? I don't care if you could sit on the cushion for 6 hours, but if you're still like an asshole the rest of your day, I mean, then there's something missing. You know, there's certain ethics that are involved in all this stuff. But you know, for me, it's always been about like bringing the two together, because I separated them for so long. And I won't go into that right now, but because I want to answer your question. So the mental fitness training is just working with your mind and working with your life. And it's not limited to the cushion. It's literally working with your life in this moment. And whatever that is, we start training our mind to be aware. I came up with this thing called ARC, right? So awareness, relaxation, and compassion, right? Or kindness. So you can spell it with a K or a C. But awareness is just the non-judgmental, intentional paying attention with a sense of warmth, curiosity, and a willingness to be there, right? Because what's our suffering? Something's wrong, something's missing, right? There's no willingness to be there. Whereas meditation is kind of this radical practice of saying, I'm willing to be here no matter what, right? And that's where the practice is so powerful. And like a lot of this new age stuff is like, feel happy, feel good, feel blissful. And it's like meditation becomes this like self-pampering where you're supposed to just feel good and that's it. But I think the most powerful stuff is the stuff that doesn't feel good and how we relate to that. And if our meditation is confined to this little happy box, then when real life happens, when you're watching your grandfather slowly die in hospice, when you lose a friend to drugs or alcohol, or, you know, when you're kids are driving you nuts and you haven't had any sleep and, you know, you have to go to work and you're dealing with crazy people at work and everything's going wrong. Like, how does sitting on a cushion, how does that help you? You know, so it always has to be practical. So we're cultivating this awareness. We're cultivating the ability to be at ease no matter what. So you're literally training your nervous system to hold anything, you know. Basically, like I kind of say, we have a spacious mind and a kind heart that can hold all the 10,000 joys and sorrows of our lives, you know, and we learn to see all that clearly, but also to soften with it, to kind of go to that tender place and be vulnerable and open and be willing to feel things, feel the ouch, right? Like the clients I work with, a lot of them have anxiety, and it's just like, they've never really truly felt it. Of course, they feel it because they know what it is and they're scared of it and they try to run away, but they've never intentionally felt like, where does it live? Your anxiety or your anger or your addiction or your fear, where in your body does it live? And can you go to that place? And can you hold that feeling with some compassion and some ease, right? And that's obviously the C is the compassion, like the unconditional friendliness. How can we cultivate unconditional friendliness towards what's arising? Now, if you're sitting every day and you're practicing being aware without judgment, with warmth, with curiosity, willingness to be there, you're practicing being at ease, even if your knee hurts or you're feeling anxious or you're sick or your mind's out of control. Like somebody said once, like being trapped in a closet with a maniac, that's pretty good. And if you're practicing, welcoming everything, unconditional friendliness, then those qualities get strengthened. And if you take that practice into daily life, you strengthen it more. If you go on retreat, you strengthen it more. And soon that's like second nature, you know, or at least you get quickly back to that place, those qualities that you've been cultivating. So that's how I kind of have been mapping it out, is just we're training particular qualities of mind. Like mindfulness, I would say, is a quality of mind. It's not just being aware. It's being aware in a very specific way with those things that I mentioned and a lot more. I mean, you could do a whole year course on mindfulness. So, you know, but those five things I think cover intentional, non-judgmental, with a sense of warm. We, you know, we're paying attention with care because we care. That's something that I just made up a couple weeks ago, but I like that, you know, with the curiosity, the willingness to be there. And then, you know, then when something goes wrong in our life, we've had training, right? Or if we are diagnosed and we have a week to live, at least we've had some training. You know, it might still crush us, but at least we have something that can help us, you know, that can help us hold those feelings, that can also help us cultivate compassion with the suffering. You know, like Ajahn Brahm talks about the truckload of dung, you know, and it's a great analogy. I just did something on Insight Timer about that. But to be able to use our trauma and our suffering and our pain as a way to cultivate other qualities like wisdom and compassion. And I just want people to have these tools and to know that they can take, you know, just like the gym, I could teach you how to run on the treadmill, how to do it. I could teach you how to lift weights. I could, and then you can go crazy with it or you could do nothing with it. You know, and the more you train, the better I hate saying results, but the better the results, you know, and it's the same. Like if you keep training your mind, there is fruits to the practice, you know, and there is, there is results, you know, I just don't like focusing on them because then people focus on the results and they miss the whole point, which is right here in the mess, right here, you know. And that's why I like the analogy of the lotus flower, because you have this flower that's blossoming and growing in the middle of this murky, disgusting water, you know, and it's not like first we got to change the pH balance and we need to take out the algae. And no, it's going to grow right there in the middle of that murky water. And even I didn't know this until recently, but it has supposedly like a waxy covering so that the water can't like stay on it, like it falls off of it. So that's interesting. I don't know if that's true. I'm not a biologist or whatever studies lotus flowers, but I think it's true.
That actually reminds me of a story that I read in this book, Your Life is Meditation, where you talked about an analogy of a spider walking on a web and how, you know, a web can be very sticky, but the spider doesn't stick to it. It just kind of walks over it. I thought that was a cool analogy that you used in the book about, you know, to your thoughts, how not sticking with your thoughts and just being able to, you know, let them pass.
Right. And, probably, you know, the spider
slaughtering that analogy, but I think, you know, what I'm talking about.
I slaughter every quote and story I tell. So it's okay. It was good. It was close. So it's the spider or the fly, right? And
yes,
you know, a fly doesn't know how to walk across the web. It gets stuck. It gets one arm stuck and then it tries to get the other arm out. I don't even think flies have arms. So we're both, you know, losing it in But then like the other arm gets stuck, and then the other, and then before you know it, it's, you know, dinner. But the spider, like, and here's where the analogy, where I really like this analogy, because the spider creates the web, right? And then it learns to walk on it without getting stuck. And it's the same with like our sense of self. Like, we create this sense of self, and not, I don't want to say there's one cause for my personality, because that's not true. So there's external influences, genetic influences, there's all kinds of influences that, that, you know, created who I am. But let's just go with that. Like, the sense of Mark is my creation, but I get stuck in it, you know, like, so I'm like the fly getting stuck in my, I'm like a spider getting stuck in my own web, basically. And our practice is like, how can we be more like the spider? And, you know, you're not getting rid of the web. It's not, and that's like, I think it's called ego phobia. And that's something that I had in the beginning. It's just like, I remember being on a retreat thinking that I had to like malnourish my ego. So I slept on the, on a towel on the floor without a pillow, without a blanket. I didn't eat anything that was sweet or that I wanted to eat. And I took cold showers. Like, it only lasted a day, but but I was like trying to get rid of my ego. And that's not the, it's not getting rid of the web. It's learning how to walk across it with ease without getting caught so much. Use it, right? But don't be so stuck in it, and don't limit your whole life to it.
That's cool. Okay. I also wanted to touch on your music career. You seem to have all these like groups of things that all sort of encompass everything about you, and that's pretty fascinating. So how did you get into music? Did you get into music before you got into meditation and being like an author and all that? How does it all kind of align with you?
Right. Yeah. And it's so funny because, like I said, I trust the process. When I look back at everything that I've done, like, it all, like, I feel like is coming together, like, and it all makes sense, like why I had to do that first or this first or that. And it's just really cool to see. But I think I first learned the recorder in like second grade, and my sister had a keyboard, and I would always like, I was always able to just like hear things and like figure out how to play it. I would always screw around on her keyboard. Then I think sixth grade, we had to pick an instrument, and I learned trumpet. I played trumpet until about junior year of high school, when I quit because I didn't like the teacher said something to me one time, and I thought I was all tough and I quit. But then I started to get into guitar. I sucked majorly at guitar. So I ended up learning bass instead, because I figured, oh, that's probably a little easier. I was right. And I got pretty good at bass. I was in some punk bands. I was in some like darker rock bands. And then I started playing guitar again. I got better at guitar. And by senior year, I didn't want to go to college. I was really pursuing like music. I mean, I was playing all over. I mean, we were doing shows at bars. We were part of contests. We got to play Webster Hall. I think I played Webster Hall 3 times in New York City, the Knitting Factory. The Bitter End, some like really cool places in New York City, in the tri-state area. So I didn't want to go to college, but my mom's like, yeah, you got to go. So I went to Bergen Community College for music. I got an associate's in music. I learned piano a little better there. I was always playing piano, but I took 2 like college courses on it, and that helped. And then at some point, you know, when I got into meditation, I started really writing about my path and the things that I was up against and the philosophies that I had. And I mean, some songs literally with meditation, I mean, songs just write themselves. I mean, it's insane. Like, when you know, you're open like that, things just come out. Like, especially after retreats, all of a sudden 3 or 4 songs would come out. I remember being in a T.S. Eliot course at college when I went back to school for religion eventually. And that course messed me up. I mean, that was a dark course, but I wrote one of my songs, wrote itself in that class in my head. And then I had to quickly run home and write it and record it. And then there was another course with, who was it? Was it another, I think it was T.S. Eliot again. That guy messed me up really bad, actually. This, you know, I wrote a song, Hollow Man, based on his poem. And the other song was Opening, if anyone ever wanted to hear it. It's by, I called myself Seeking the Seeker, right? And even in my music, you could hear like the change in my practice. You know, first it was like I was searching and then looking for God and trying to find this like blissful, enlightened thing that, you know, never came. And then it was more like facing the darkness and facing the messed up things. And you can just hear it all in the music. And obviously each song's different and different moods and things like that. But yeah, so then I was writing like that. And now it's just I write for fun. I mean, I still write sometimes, Seeking the Seeker stuff. I write some other stuff under my high school band's name, Joanne's Basement. We only put out 2 songs, but it's like punk rock. And then I write with this other friend of mine, Dave, and we just write all kinds of crazy things. Some things are poppy and punky. Some things are like ballads. Some things are dark. Like, it's just, for me, music is just so fun. And it's just, I'm able to express what I'm feeling, you know, and what my unconscious is feeling a lot of times. Just, I don't even know where this stuff comes from. You know, it just appears in my head and I have to put it out there. So that's like my music story. I'd still like to be a rock star, but I've given up the dream. Just if one of my songs happens to get big, I guess I'll do it. But
you never know. The way it is nowadays, you know, some kid will pick up something sometimes off SoundCloud or I don't know, whatever the latest thing is. It's probably not SoundCloud anymore. I can't keep up anymore. But, you know, and then all of a sudden they're all playing it. So you never know.
Right. So if anyone's out there listening, sign me up.
Awesome.
But now we just play cover, like I'm in just like an acoustic cover band. And that's just fun because I haven't performed, you know, in a while. So it's just really nice to perform again and just put on a show and all that stuff. So
that's cool. What does your wife think of that? Does she like your music and go, is she like a groupie type person or?
Well, not she used to be, but now she's got to stay home, you know, because it's just like, and it's funny because like her parents and aunts will all be there and they should be the ones watching them and they end up coming.
Oh, that's cool. So. That's cool. Okay. So you've written 2 books. What do you see for your future? Do you see yourself writing more books?
I have 2 more ideas, but right now it's like, I barely have time to go to the bathroom,
yeah.
Let alone write. But occasionally like ideas, like I'm writing one on the 4 Noble Truths.
Nice.
Very practical, like secular understanding of that. And actually I have like 70 pages of that, but it's for me, like, and I, to go back to what you were saying about, you know, writing the book, there's just a time when it's right. And you know, it like, it's just all of a sudden it's like, yeah, I got to write this now. And then it just like starts happening. It's not that time right now. I also have another book, that I wanted to write on addictions or, you know, working with addictive cravings. I didn't know if I wanted to be like specific or, you know, wide with it. But again, it's maybe when my kids are older and I'm all alone and sad, I could write some more books. But, you know, for me, I'm trying to build this mental fitness training, trying to make my life the Dharma, literally. Like, mm-hmm. I want to just teach full time because, you know, the chip company's great. It's good benefits. It's decent pay. I don't want to say it's great, but it's steady and I get paid leave. You know, I get time off, sick days. So that's all good stuff. But 40 to 45 hours, I'm driving around delivering potato chips where I could be working with 40 individual people, helping them work with their anxiety or their depression, or, you know, making them feel more at ease in their life. And that's my calling. And that's, you know, so short term is trying to, I guess, you know, it stinks that we have to do this within corporate America. You know, it's like, I have to build a business out of it. But, you know, if I don't, then I won't reach all these people, you know? So that's how I justify it. It's like, how do I justify marketing and, you know, cheesy trying to like hook people and do this? Well, if I don't, then they don't hear me and they don't hear the teachings and they don't have their lives changed. So I have to jump through the stupid hoops and do the whole, you know, the whole thing. And I don't know. I'm just seeing where life is leading me, because it's just bringing me in all kinds of crazy places that I never thought I would even be in. So I'm along for the ride. I'm not passive. You know, I'm actively doing things. I'm reaching out. Like, I reached out to you and I got with, you know, with John and all these different people. I'm just trying to make some connections. Some work, some don't. And just see where it leads me, because, you know, especially with these podcasts, I love doing it because you just never know who's going to listen or what you say might touch somebody in a, you know, deep way and really help. I mean, it's so cool because ever since my books are out, and especially with Insight Timer, you know, they're worldwide. So, and so is my publisher. So I get emails from, I got one from like China, from Australia, Germany, you know, Canada. And it's just like, wow, like I'm just one person living like my normal life, just meditating and trying to help people. And I'm touching people all over the world. Like, I think it's really cool. And now with Zoom and all this stuff, it's like, I can have clients in a different country and it's not a problem. I mean, as long as they speak English, so they understand me. But other than that, you know, we're not limited anymore like we used to be. And, you know, it's one thing that the pandemic showed us is that we can connect with people all over, you know. It's obviously a little different than like me sitting there on the couch with you would be cool, but I mean, this is just as good.
Yeah. It opens it up. It really does. It's technology is pretty awesome that way. Insight Timer is great. We actually had the opportunity to interview the CEO of Insight Timer, and he was awesome. Wow. Just awesome. Yeah, I was so nervous because, I mean, he's the CEO of Insight Timer, right? Yeah, right. And he was so laid back. And of course, I'm drawing a blank on his name because that always happens to me and I'm not prepared. I remember his first name's Christopher. I can't think of his last name now.
It's Christopher Insight.
Yeah. Christopher Insight. Back. I felt like we were like, you know, sitting there drinking beers together or something like that. And then after it was over, I was like, wow. It was awesome.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, they're a great, yeah, they're not really a company, are they? Are they nonprofit? I think they're nonprofit.
Are they? I'm not sure about.
I'm not sure either. But anyway, I digress. So I think we've covered everything. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Just that the world needs people who practice and that are dedicated to practice. And my lifelong passion and job, it seems, why I'm here is to support that practice for people. So, you know, if you resonate with how I teach, which not everybody will, and I understand that. But if you do, and you feel like you need some support in your life, you know, don't hesitate to reach out. Whether it's to me or to a local community, there's sanghas everywhere. There's even just spiritual people everywhere. You got to find what's comfortable for you, but just to do your practice and to take the time, even though we're in the West and we think we need to be doing all the time, but to just take some time to be and to really nourish your mental health, you know, and nourish your spiritual, you know, practice or your soul, or I don't know, whatever you want to call it, just that deeper aspect and try not to forget that deeper part of life, you know, like think of it like you swimming in the shallow end with your feet in the deep end, you know, like, and, but visit the deep end often too, but always keep one foot there. Like, remind yourself of some basic things, impermanence, remind yourself that life has suffering and difficulty, that you're not being punished, that there's nothing wrong with you, that this is just a part of the experience. And these are the ingredients of your life right now, and they will change. And practice really helps you see that. It helps you hold that. It reminds you that you have a refuge within yourself that can hold anything, you know, and we're spacious enough to hold everything, and to hold each other when we feel like we can't hold everything, you know? So I don't know, I'm going on a rant now, but you know, just practice. I know it's boring sometimes. I know it feels like nothing's changing, but things are happening. Your neural makeup is changing. Your neural pathways are changing just by paying attention differently. So if you need science, I know everyone needs science nowadays. So there you go. Your neurons are changing. So keep sitting and breathing and relaxing, and yeah, reach out to me, connect with me. I love meeting people on the path that are authentically and honestly trying to just work with what has been given, you know, to them. And this world is really broken, and it's a really difficult place, you know, to be in. And if we can try our best, you know, these are the three commitments, and I stole them from Pema Chodron, so I'll give her some credit. But the three commitments, this is what I'll end with. Commitment number one, try to cause the least amount of harm and take that to whatever level that you're able to take that to. But, you know, what with words, with actions, and with what you choose to indulge in your mind, cause the least amount of harm. Commitment number two, bring the most ease into the world. How can you ease suffering every day? How can you ease somebody's suffering? Make a phone call, smile, just see somebody, give somebody your time, give somebody, you know, your attention, just looking at the cashier of wherever you're at. Like, most people don't look at them. They don't acknowledge there's a human standing there with suffering and difficulty and hopes and fears. And, you know, so just to acknowledge people, to call people, to send flowers, to cook dinner for people who are sick. I mean, it's all, you don't have to save lives. If you can, great. But just simple ways to ease other people's suffering is the second commitment. And the third one is just learning to open to life, to really expand your sense of self to include everything, right? Because otherwise you're just going to be fighting. I mean, you can't fit life inside your bubble. You have to either expand your bubble or pop it, you know? And that's what this practice is all about, is learning to sit with what is, learning to be with, we'll get all Buddhist, things as they are, you know, and to be aware, to be relaxed, and to be compassionate. I mean, I think ARC is a really nice thing that I need to write another book about.
There you go. Yeah, these books are pretty awesome. I was not able to read them both cover to cover, but I read quite a bit of them. One thing I liked about, we're supposed to be wrapping up, but I wanted to say this. One thing I liked about your book, both books actually, is that they're not the type of book that you have to read cover to cover. Like, you pick them up, and I found myself like, oh, this chapter looks interesting, and I'd read it, and then I actually made a few notes. You know, and then I would flip through, and then they're short, and
yes,
that's
the best part.
Yes, I mean, because I love to read, but it can be hard. It sounds horrible, but it can hard to fit it in at times. And the shorter chapters, like, you can read 2-3 chapters in just a few minutes, well, maybe not a few minutes, but I'm probably exaggerating a little bit, but it doesn't take long to sit and read 2-3 chapters because the concept is right there. You get it. You read it. It's something to think about, you know, and then you move on and then you come back to it. And both books are like this. And I think that's accessible to everybody. It's little short snippets that will stick with you as opposed to sitting there and reading, you know, a 20-page chapter. You know, and then maybe you're like, wait, what was the first part of the chapter again? So I love the way it's set up actually for both books.
Right. You know, when I'm reading a book, if I whenever I start a chapter and I read one or two pages, then I'm like flipping, like, when the hell is this chapter going to be over? Because I want to, like, I don't like stopping in the middle of a chapter. Yeah. I want to finish the chapter. So that's why I like the really short chapters. And that's what I do. And, you know, thank you, Dr. Johnson, because if you didn't work with me, you'd have like 700 pages of fluff, you know. So now there's no more fluff.
Both books are very good. So I really like that about them. And it was really nice talking to you.
Same.
And I can't say enough. Definitely check him out. Check out his website, mental fitness training, his whole little thing with that, and the meditation instruction. Check out his books published by Wisdom Publications. And check out his music too. So... awesome. Thank you so much for being here with us, with me today. Yeah. It's us.
Yes. Thank you for having me.